In April 1789, a famous mutiny took place in the South Pacific. The HMS Bounty, captained by William Bligh, was sailing from Tahiti to Jamaica when one of the officers, a man called Fletcher Christian, took control of the ship, and Captain Bligh, with 18 loyal men, were set adrift in a small boat. Remarkably, they navigated over 5,800 kilometres in a rowing boat and were saved from an awful death on the seas. William Bligh was said to have been a harsh captain, and it was under provocation that the men had mutinied on that day in April 1789. It's one example of how hardship and suffering can provoke people to extreme ends, to take things into their own hands, to try to find justice for themselves or to go their own way in their own understanding. Mutiny is one of those examples. A revolution in a nation is another one. The nation's had enough, perhaps, of a harsh leadership, and so the people take to arms and they do all that they can to overthrow their government and to bring the kind of government that they would be happy with, or that they think, at least, they would be happy with. And Peter knows that persecution is coming to the churches that he's writing to here in his first epistle. Those churches there in Central Asia, which were small and perhaps struggling, perhaps having little in the way of resources, little perhaps in the way of a trained leadership. And Peter is writing to them with a great deal of earnestness. With a pastor's heart, he wants these people to be prepared for hardship, for suffering, for persecution that he is sure is coming their way. He knows, you see, that persecution is the breeding ground for discontent, for disharmony, and for temptation to all kinds of sins. And he doesn't want his people to be unprepared for this. So he's been writing in this letter, and he's been warning them, and he's been guiding and directing them so that they would be ready for that day. And here in the penultimate section of this book, in verses 5 through to 11 of 1 Peter chapter 5, he gives some final instructions to the church, the churches to whom he's writing, specific instructions on how believers are to conduct themselves within the church in the face of this imminent persecution. And the first thing he says to them is that they must be submissive. He's addressed the elders in the church. He's told the elders that they should have right motives for being there in leadership in the church, that they shouldn't be motivated simply out of a sense of duty, either to God or to the people who expect them to take leadership, that they shouldn't be motivated by a desire to gain material wealth or status in the community. But they should be motivated out of a desire to shepherd the flock of God, to lead that flock not by compulsion, but by example. Not in a heavy-handed way, but gently, with authority given from God, but in holiness and godliness. And he knows that while that is good, and while that is important, to have a good, strong, firm leadership in the church, there is something more. Leaders aren't the only people in the church. And so he says to everyone there, be submissive. A good leadership is useless if the people will not follow. And he knows that harmony can only exist within the church if there is submission in the church. And this, he knows, is especially true when periods of persecution come. It's fairly easy when everything is going fine, when life is comfortable, when there is no persecution, no suffering for us to endure. It's fairly easy for us to get along. We make allowances for the small inconsistencies in each other and for the little things that may irritate us, because everything else is okay, so we can put up with those things. But when everything else is not okay, then a lack of submission becomes increasingly more obvious. And so Peter writes to these people and he says, I've spoken to your elders. I've instructed them in the way that they should conduct themselves in the church. Now I want you to follow their leadership, to be submissive to them and to each other. You know, an army requires discipline and it requires submission to the leaders, the captains, the sergeants, the corporals, whoever. And that's especially true in the midst of a battle, isn't it? That all that training that they may have undergone in peacetime comes into its own when they're on the battlefield, when they're coping perhaps with difficult terrain. And then in addition to that, they have the enemy shooting at them. They must be disciplined. They must be able to cope with deprivation, a lack of sleep and a lack of food. They must battle away there, and they must do it in unity. They must be working for each other. It's not a case of every man for himself. The trained soldier knows his place in the ranks, and he fights there beside his comrades, and he fights, if necessary, to the end. He does not run. He does not flee until the sergeant calls them to retreat. There must be a carelessness of one's own life in favour of the group. We rely on that in our armies. And we ourselves are called into the army of God. We've been recruited into his ranks, and we are fighting his warfare. And when persecution and sufferings and trials comes, that's the kind of picture that we ought to have in our minds, that we are fighting a warfare. We stand side by side. It's not every man for himself. And we must be willing to sacrifice ourselves. We must be willing to exert ourselves selflessly in the face of danger, in the face of difficulties, for the sake of God's army, for the sake of other people. Who is it that receives the awards after battle? Who gets the medals for valour? It's the ones who have gone beyond the call of duty in fighting the battle. Those who have put themselves in the line of fire in order to save their comrades. Alvin York was a sergeant. He was a pacifist, but he had been conscripted into the American army during the First World War, and he fought alongside his own countrymen. And at one point in the battle, as more and more of their own men were being lost, Alvin York decided that he must fight, that he must not simply be on the defensive, he must go on the offensive, that in order to save lives, it may be necessary for him to take lives. And on that one day in the First World War, Alvin York single-handedly captured 132 German soldiers. An amazing feat. And he risked his life to do so. And he risked his life in order to save the lives of others. No wonder he was awarded medals not only by the American government, but also by some of the European governments, for his bravery and for exerting himself in that way. Not every man for himself, but every man for the group. And that's how we need to be in the church, not doing our own thing, but following our leaders and ultimately following Jesus Christ himself and fighting this battle together and doing all that we can to help and strengthen and encourage each other in the persecution that may await us. But notice that Peter here particularly, though not exclusively, applies this to the young people in the church. He says there in verse 5, "Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders." Yes, all of you be submissive to one another, but especially you younger people. Why single out the young people? Well, as older people are so aware, younger people have a tendency to think that they know it all, that they understand almost everything. They're able to comment authoritatively on almost every subject that you may care to be talking about. And often they look with almost pitying incredulity at the ignorance, as they perceive it, of their elders. It reminds me of the young man who said, "When I was a teenager, I was amazed at how ignorant my father was. Now I'm in my 20s, I'm amazed at how much he's learned so quickly." What's he saying? Well, when I was a teenager, Dad didn't know anything and I knew everything. But I've grown up a bit and I realise I don't know everything, and Dad knows an awful lot more than I credited to him. Elders in the church catch a lot of flack from youngsters in the church. They think that they have all the answers to the church's problems. They know the way that the church should be moving. They know the things that the church should be doing. They know the activities that would cause tremendous growth in the church. They understand all these things in a way that the elders, being older and out of date, don't understand and don't know. Young people may well be better educated, and they may have had experiences that older people haven't had. They may have travelled to far more countries, seen all sorts of wonderful things. But younger people do not have the life experiences that older folk have. They haven't seen the effects of different circumstances on life. They haven't seen the troubles, the turmoils, the pleasures and the joys that people go through. They haven't seen the great changes that can take place, even in one family, taking them poverty to riches, or from riches to poverty, from happiness to great sadness. They lack an experience of life. And Peter says to the younger people, as well as to the others, but particularly to the younger people who perhaps have a tendency to think they know better, submit yourselves to your elders. Don't cast them off as having exceeded their shelf life. My pastor that I grew up under, Geoffrey Thomas in Aberystwyth, he recently wrote a book based on some messages that he gave at a conference in Wales. And it was a book on Daniel. He preached through the whole book in four sermons, looking at the lives of Daniel, the life of Daniel under the four kings there. And he dedicated that book to Esther Jones. I remember Esther Jones when I was 9 years old, a boy in the Sunday school. She was teaching then, always taught the younger class in the Sunday school. She was a dwarf. She had severe health problems. And probably by the time I was about 12, she was no longer able to get along to church. And ever since then, she's lived in a little terraced house in the town, quietly praying for everyone in the church, reading and studying her Bible, and being an immense encouragement to everyone who would visit her. And Jeff Thomas dedicates this little book to her with a statement something to the effect that this woman, a nobody really, had been such an encouragement and an inspiration to him. An older woman who had seen many things and had many experiences and could help an elder in the church with her wisdom. No one is past their shelf life. Everyone has something to offer. And in my experience, older Christians have far more to offer than younger Christians. Yes, young Christians have a great zeal, and that's wonderful. And they have great potential, and that is good, if it can be channeled and perhaps guided by older Christians who have the experience to help. And that's what Peter is saying here. He's not saying older folks are no good. He's not saying younger folks are no good. We need each other. So he says then, not just young people, submit yourselves to your elders, but everyone, be submissive to one another. Recognize older folk. Recognize the potential of the young people in the congregation. Recognize their gifts. Recognize their experiences. We're working together. We're striving together in this army of God. We march shoulder to shoulder, and we need each other. And if there is to be harmony, and if there is to be an effective enduring of persecution, then we need to submit to one another. But he says also, be humble. Submit yourselves to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Peter is actually taking a step back, as it were. You know, he knows that submission, as good a thing as it is, will never really be there unless there's humility. There may be a show of submission, but it isn't a heart submission unless there is humility. It's an outgrowth of humility. If we think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think, if we think more lowly of others than we ought to think, then it will be very difficult, if not impossible, for us to submit to others. Submission must come out of a heart that knows and understands the needs of others and our need for others. Someone may ask for guidance, may ask for advice, but they won't take that advice if they think that they know better. There must be humility. Humility that recognizes the gifts and the experiences of others and recognizes that we're not the most important person in the church. But there's something more here. There's something that would underlie even that, a humility towards one another, and that is that there must be a humility before God. Peter goes on and says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. Humility won't be there, won't extend to our relationship with others unless we first are humble before God. No, it's only when we realize who we are before God that we begin to realize who we are in comparison with others. It's only as we realize God's greatness and the fact that we are his creatures and that we are creatures who have fallen from him. We've gone our own way. We've done our own thing. As Isaiah puts it, we all, like sheep, have gone astray. We have gone everyone his own way. And it's when we recognize ourselves and our position before God that we begin to see that actually we're no better than anyone else. That in fact we're all more or less in the same boat. We all live life more or less the same way. Different sins, admittedly, but we're all sinners nevertheless. Different strengths and weaknesses, yes. But all nothing compared to God. And until we humble ourselves before God and acknowledge him to be who he is and we in relation to him, nothing. It's when we recognize that our strength is weakness in comparison to God that our weakness can be turned into strength by God. Isn't that what Paul writes to the Romans and again to the Corinthians? That God's strength is made perfect in our weakness. That God chose what the strong things of this world, the mighty things of this world, the wise things of this world. No. God chose the weak things of this world. God chose the poor things of this world. God chose the foolish things of this world to confound the wise, the mighty. God demonstrates in our weakness the bankruptcy of the world. Oh, it thinks it's strong. It thinks it's wise. It thinks it knows where it's going. But we who acknowledge that we're not strong and we're not wise, and that we do need a crutch. How many times have you heard that? Oh, God's only for people who need a crutch. Amen. Amen to that. God is for people who need a crutch. The thing is, the whole world needs this crutch. The whole world needs Jesus Christ. The whole world needs him to come and heal them and pick them up and carry them home. But the world won't acknowledge its need, won't acknowledge its weakness. But we who do are made strong through Jesus Christ. He takes our weakness and he transforms it into strength. And it's humility, you see, that is the precursor to all of that. Humility forms the underlying prerequisite to God's care for us. We maintain a proud attitude. If we are proud in our abilities, in our resources, then God will leave us to our own devices. What does he say in Romans 1 concerning those who have entered into all kinds of wickedness? Basically, gone their own way, done their own things according to their own wisdom and understanding. What does God say? So I have left them to their own devices, to go their own way. We need to learn to be humble before God. Then he will exalt us. Then he will raise us up. Oh, we won't be exalted in the eyes of the world. But we will be exalted before God into a position of great blessing. We need to acknowledge our need of his strength, of his help. We need, as Peter then says, to cast our cares upon him. knowing that we can't cope ourselves. We need Him to care for us. It's only then that we can live in a peaceful assurance of His aid. You've seen it with a young child. A young child seems to be troubled and careworn. And you as a parent may have asked that young boy or girl, well, what's the problem? What's troubling you? And eventually they unburden themselves. They cast their cares on you as a parent. And there seems almost immediately to be that their troubles have just gone. They've shared it with you, and now in their mind you're carrying the burden. You have their problems. You'll sort them out. Daddy'll sort the problem out, the young child thinks. No need for me to worry about it anymore. Well, they don't reason it that way, but you see it in them, don't you? The child who's been tossing and turning in their bed and then is able to sleep soundly, knowing that their mum or their dad cares for them. That's how we ought to be. That's the kind of thing that Jesus is getting at when he tells us that we're to be as little children. We're to cast our cares upon the Lord and then be confident that he carries those problems and he will sort them out. And we can have a peaceful assurance that he will help and strengthen us. And then thirdly, Peter says, after you've been submissive, while you're being humble, you need to be resistant. He's provided here a foundation of humility and submission. And Peter is now exhorting his readers to holiness. He's done it before, earlier in the book, in a positive way. He's been telling them, do this, do that. And now he does it in a kind of a negative way. He says, don't do this. What is he saying? Because it doesn't look very negative. He says, resist, steadfast in the faith. Well, he's saying, don't give in to temptation, isn't he? He's saying, don't allow Satan to be your master. He says, don't allow yourself to be overtaken by the powers of darkness. Resist these things. It's all very well trying to do what is right, but there's another side to the coin. You must avoid doing what is wrong. You must turn away, not only from the sin, but if you possibly can, from the temptation to sin. You know, someone who's been an alcoholic, someone who's had a problem with alcohol, it would be foolish for them to go into a pub. Someone else who's never had a problem may quite easily be able to go in, have a drink of lemonade, have a chat with their friends and leave. No problem. But someone who has had a problem, just going in there puts them into a place of such huge temptation. It's folly for them to do that. And that's what Peter's saying here. We need not only to pursue what is right, but we need to flee from what is wrong. We need not only to follow God, but we need to resist Satan. The great theme of 1 Peter, as I've said time and time again, is that we are to live godly lives in a godless world. And in order to do that, we must resist temptation. If we're in a godless world, obviously, there's going to be temptation to sin. That's what it means, doesn't it? That all around us, people are not doing what is right, are walking in ungodliness, and there will be the temptation to join with them. So Peter says, now I've told you to be submissive, and I've told you to be humble, and you need both of those things if you are going to resist the devil. He says, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him. Be steadfast in the faith. Resisting the devil, you see, involves, firstly, a sober, or as we might otherwise translate it, a realistic vigilance. It's a sober vigilance, a realistic vigilance, in that we have to be aware of what's going on around us. We need to be realistic about our weaknesses and our strengths. We need to be realistic about just how sinful the world is in which we live. We need to be realistic about just how devious Satan can be in his attempt to take us away from God and to make us fall into sin. We need to be realistic about all these things. We need to be vigilant then. It reminds me of Bunyan's book, The Holy War. You are all familiar, I'm sure, with Pilgrim's Progress. Perhaps you're not so familiar with The Holy War. It's written along a similar line. And it centres on a city called Mansoul. And it talks about the way that Satan attacks this city. And Bunyan says that this city has various gates. It has eye gate and ear gate. And Bunyan talks about the way that the leaders of the city had to be particularly vigilant at certain gates, because that was where the devil was more likely to come in and to attack that city. We need to be vigilant. We need to be aware of what's around us, and we need to be watchful. We need to be constantly on our guard against attack. But this vigilance must also be coupled with a humble dependence upon God. We're moving back up through this argument, if you like, of what Peter has been saying. He's telling them to resist the devil, but in order to resist the devil, they must have a humble dependence on God, knowing that they are weak without God, knowing that they cannot resist the devil without God's help and strength. And then Peter says, well, not only in order to resist the devil, not only must you be have a dependence on God, but you must have a mutual submission to one another. Why is that? Well, look at the way that Peter pictures the devil here. He says that the devil is like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. The devil is like a lion, a hungry lion. You've seen documentaries, I expect, on Africa and the lions there, and you see them as they go out to hunt, and how careful they are to hide themselves from their prey as they circle around and prepare to attack. And have you seen what their prey do as soon as they sense that there's some danger? What is it they do? They all huddle up together. Those beautiful gazelles who have just been grazing there, all of a sudden they make a tight bunch, watching, looking. And what does the lion do? The lion waits and perhaps pushes in a little and tries to move them a little. What's he looking for? He's looking for one to break away. It's no good attacking the whole bunch. It's just the one. We are like sheep. And our best defense is in huddling together, not going it alone. So you see why Peter says, submit yourselves to one another. You can't be a lone Christian. And if you dare to follow that road, you are in grave danger. You've got no one to huddle with. You've got no defences. Satan, who prowls around like a roaring lion, is looking for just the kind of Christian that you would be, out there, all by himself. No advisers, no protectors, no fellowship. Just a lone Christian. A sitting target for the devil. So godly living in a godless world is entirely dependent on God's grace, using the resources that he's given to us. And that means the church. That means fellowship together. That means submitting one to another, especially when persecution comes, that great tool of the devil to disrupt and destroy the church. And look how Peter describes our utter dependence on God's grace. He says there in verse 10, "May the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you." Peter knows that it is God who must perfect us. The Greek word underlying this actually means something along the lines of making an adequate or a sufficient, making someone sufficient for something, making one adequate for something. You know, you don't send a young child out to be the breadwinner in the family, do you? Just imagine some of the children here going out. You wouldn't be too hopeful of having a meal on the table at the end of the day. Why? Well, because they're not sufficient for that task, are they? We train them up. We teach them. We wait until they're physically mature and have the intellectual ability to go out and do a day's work and bring home the bacon. And it is God who must work in us to perfect us, to make us adequate, to make us sufficient for the task that he has given us to do. We are dependent on him to make us able. It is God who must establish. In other words, he is the one who makes us strong, makes us firm and unchanging in our attitudes and beliefs. You notice that very often, very young Christians, and I don't mean young in physical age, but those who are newly saved, are often miraculously kept from trials that face other Christians. And it's because they're an infant and God is caring for them and sheltering and protecting them to a greater degree than he does for those who are more mature. Just as you do with your children. And it is God who establishes us. It is God who grows us to a point where we have a firm, unchanging belief in his word and in his trustworthiness and in the doctrines that are contained in his word, so that we're able to resist the devil. So he brings us to that point where we're able to go out and fight this fight in his strength. God must strengthen is the next word that Peter uses. He's the one who makes a person capable of undergoing certain experiences. It's similar to his perfecting of us, making us adequate, sufficient for something. But this is more particularly related to perhaps specific experiences, undergoing persecution, for example, as this church is about to do. God will strengthen you for this experience that is coming your way. And God must settle you. It is God who gives a basis, a firm basis for your belief and for your practice. He settles you there as on a foundation so that you will not be moved. And we are utterly dependent on God. And we must look to him for his strength and for his enabling. This is God's call to us, that we are to live godly lives in a godless world. And we must humble ourselves before God. We must be completely dependent upon him for the graces that he will give us to be godly in a godless world. And we must join together and unite our hearts together and unite our strength together in our effort to resist the devil and to live godly in this godless world. And so you see, from beginning to end of our Christian lives, it is God who works in and through us. Peter said at the beginning of his epistle that it is God who was working in them. It is God who had brought them out of darkness into light. It is God who had given them this salvation in which they stood. And at the end of the epistle, Peter is saying, it is God who perfects, it is God who establishes, it is God who strengthens and settles you. It is God from beginning to end. It's not just God's there at the beginning and he gives us a helpful push to get us on our way. God is there every step of the way. We need to know that, we need to understand that, and we need to live our lives appropriately, casting all our cares on him. Because he does care for us. Well, may we, as Peter says, give him the glory and the dominion forever and ever. He alone is worthy of our praise. Amen.